This is Infidel One. Offending Coyote Down. Offending Coyote Down.
Roger that.
Welcome to Trappin' Radio. We're proud, organic, free-range, wild fur farmers of North America.
Let me tell you a little story about how I was raised. Every day work, every day pray. Got family, friends, yeah, everybody sins. A winner never quits, and a quitter never wins. Help folks in need, don't fall for greed. A jealous man is weak, so think before you speak. If you love them, let them know. If you hate, let it go. Fast can be fun, but sometimes you need slow. God is all good, the devil is so real. So listen up, y'all, cause this is how I feel.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got none. Except for the good Lord up above. I answer to no one.
Now let's cover our sponsors. They do a lot to help support Trappin' Radio. So I'm asking you guys out there and gals to help support our sponsors as they keep Trappin' Radio on the air. First sponsors, Oki Cable and Trap Supply. Jeb's the owner of this. He's out of Oklahoma. Super guy. You'll not meet anybody nicer. It's somebody you're going to want to deal with. You can reach him at oktrapsupply.com. You can give Jeb a call at 918-429-4648. Not only does he do trap supply guys, he's a fur buyer, so if you're around the Oklahoma or surrounding states, give him a call with your fur. When you need stuff, give him a call and he'll get it out to you as soon as he can. Our second sponsor is F&T Fur Harvesters Trading Post. Everything you need for trapping, hunting with hounds, and predator calling. Guys, if you're into trapping fur, hunting fur, chasing fur with dogs, you're not going to be able to think of hardly anything that you can't get from F&T. You can reach them at fntpost.com. You can also give them a call at 989-727-8727. Whatever you want, F&T's got it. Blue Ridge Outdoor Supplies. Scott Payne is the owner of this business. He's in Elkton, Virginia. He also has a lure line, Mountain Rebel Lures and Baits. He's got a great coyote trapping video. He's also a fur buyer in Virginia. Anything that you're looking for and your trapping needs, give Scott a call and he'll get it right out to you. Wildlife Control Supplies, proven solutions for wildlife control, delivering value, expertise, and products to the wildlife individual. If you're an ADC business, control business, even fur trapping, you need to look at these guys' website. Top-notch company, have everything you would want, even the odd stuff that ADC guys are looking for. You can reach them at wildlifecontrolsupplies.com. You can give them a call at 877-684-7262. International number is 860-844-0101. If you're a wildlife control professional, you need to have Wildlife Control Supplies as one of your favorites on your computer or your phone, because when you come across something that you need specialized equipment, Alan will get it right out to you. Now let's go trapping.
See, I'm a flag flying, Bible toting son of a gun. Yeah, I'm hell on the heart, just a rebel on the run. Scared, don't know it. Fear, don't feel it. The truth is the light. Sometimes you gotta fight. Good beats bad, right beats wrong. I'm a barroom preacher and this is my song. I'm climbing for the top, representing for the country. I'm the people's champ, right out to dig. Shotgun toter, Republican voter, Hank Jr. supporter, let's protect our border. To hell with anyone who don't believe in the USA, cause this is what I say.
I won't back up, I don't back down. I've been raised up to stand my ground. Take my job, but not my guns. Tax my check till I ain't got...
Well, hello everybody. Beautiful, beautiful spring. At least I hope it is wherever you're at. Today happens to be. Now, my wife gave me a surprise last week. She jerked me down to Florida for a few days, and I have to admit it was nice. It was kind of a surprise thing. It was really cool. You know, I like going down to Florida. There's no doubt you know, in my mind, scenery's always good most of the time. And then I like to ocean fish. You know, it's one of those few things that you don't never know what you're going to get. Now, guys, I know this is a trapping thing, but I want to tell you, if you're a male that likes having a little bit of thrill about something, I've got something you can do off-season that I promise you will get your adrenaline up just a little bit. Me and Cindy have these fishing kayaks. We take them down to the river that, you know, catching a bass or a brim or a catfish, you know, even if it's a 50-pound catfish, that's not the same. When we took these things out in the Gulf of Mexico, and you get away from the sandbars and the water's black because it's deep, and you catch something that you're doing everything you can just not to flip the kayak over, and you're in something else's wheelhouse, you're out in the ocean, you got waves coming at you, you got this thing jerking you around. The first day I went out, I caught about a 44 inch king mackerel. I don't know what it weighs, it's pretty heavy. And about 30 minutes, that thing drug me all over the Gulf. I thought I was going to Cuba. I mean, it was a trip. The power of those fish is amazing. And doing it out of a kayak, oh, it's just the thrill of the life. Then right before we left, I hooked about a 5.5-foot shark, black tip. It is way over 100 pounds. I'm not way over, but it is over 100 pounds because I couldn't hardly lift the dang thing up to get pictures with it. And I fought that for 2 hours on a fishing rod. Now, that's not the same as shark fishing out of a boat where you can stand up and you know that the shark's not going to come up and eat through the boat. It's not going to do that. And it's not the same as when I catch them from the shore when I'm surf fishing for them. For 2 hours, basically, this 100-pound shark drugged me all over the place. Cindy was watching, and she thought I was out there piddling because I was getting further and further away. Then I'd go way down shore. I was just holding on. The best I could do with the shark for about an hour and a half was basically just keep the rudder of the kayak following him. That was it. And power, every muscle in my body was screaming. Now, I'm sitting there after about an hour and a half of this. I can tell the shark's kind of wearing down by now. I'm absolutely burnt, just physically burnt. And I'm deciding, because we eat shark. We eat a lot of shark throughout the year. You know, we normally go down there and we get some. So I want the shark, but there's no way I can drag a 100-pound shark on a 12-foot kayak. There is no way. So I do the stupid thing, and I just fight it and fight it and fight it till it seems like it's slowing down. And I put the rod back in the rod holder of the kayak, and I just start pedaling like a banshee for shore. So me and that shark's playing tug of war all the way through. Let me tell you what happens with a kayak. And if you've never seen a Hobie Pro Angler, they've got a TV show on the Outdoor Channel or Pursuit or one of those channels. And it's called Hobie Outdoors, and it's always about fishing. If you're going to get into kayaks and you're not used to being around water, let me give you a word of advice. There is a reason that they never, ever, not once show the kayaks coming back to shore. Because when you put a kayak in surf with tide and wind, about half the time you're eating sand before you get out of that. Luckily, I didn't have any epic crashes and burns this time. Now, Cindy, she had a pretty good one. Lost a pair of Costa sunglasses. If you know what those are, you know how bad that hurt. She flipped before she got all the way up to the bank. But so I've got this shark hooked to me on this kayak with a 30-pound test line. It's pulling one way. I'm paddling as hard as I can to get back to the shore. And when I hit the surf, I mean, it was just absolutely luck of the fishing gods that that thing did not jerk at the wrong moment. Because if it would have, I'd have been about chest deep with a 5.5-pound pissed off shark, not sure what I was going to do. And I didn't really think it through that much. But once I got it to shore, you know, I sat there for another 30 minutes to get it to the shore. And then it was the dangest thing. I'm telling you, this happens with trapping, it happens with fishing, it happens with hunting. We're on a public beach, on the, you know, outside of Destin, Florida, towards Panama City. And, you know, I come in and I basically crash land into the beach. Cindy grabs the kayak, so I don't have to worry about it. I jump out, grab the rod off the back. I start fighting this shark again. You know, most people surf fish and they may catch a pompano or something like that. Well, I mean, everybody saw me fighting this whatever it was. And most people were watching me fight it out in the ocean. So I had a crowd around me when I get that thing up. And all the, you know, the people, you know, cool, that's great, man, can I take a picture, yada, yada. Oh, that's so sad. I mean, what are you going to do with it? And, you know, me being who I am, well, my God, I'm going to eat it. That's what I'm going to do with it. I didn't bring it back to pet it. So I got this brand new gaff. This really high-speed looking thing from a local place down there, because I lost my gaff on the, my original gaff on the King Mackerel. So I went and bought another one. This thing broke before it ever got through the skin one time. So I've got this great big shark. It's very alive, half in, half out of the surf, and I'm trying to drag him up, and I'm trying to think if it can chew on me or not. So I get it up on the bank, and I'm pretty sure the way the laws are in Florida, they're not going to take very kindly to me pulling out the 45 and shooting a shark in the head. So I'm looking around, and I got all these people around me. All these people around me. People with GoPros and phones and everything else. And I'm talking, and I'm trying to... There ain't no way to hide on the beach. And this shark's going, they're going, well, how are you going to dispatch it? And I go, well, I guess I'm going to brain him. Let me tell you, the crap that happens to an outdoorsman. So I've got a Dexter heavy-duty fillet knife that I bought at Bass Pro a couple of years ago. Decent blade on it. You know, I thought it was a full tang. Found out it wasn't. So I grab that shark, and I stab it, you know, right where I think its brain's going to be. And when I go to move the knife to make sure I get into something that turns his power off, the handle breaks off. So I've got all these people standing around me, and I've got a spike sticking out of this shark's head, and I'm sitting there going, well, I don't think that went deep enough. And I'm looking around, and I didn't know what else to do. And there's all these oohs and ahs, and oh, how pitiful, this, that, and the other. So I did what any outdoorsman do at that time. I have a little bat that I stun fish with. I grabbed that thing, and I just drove that knife with a baseball bat like a hammer and a nail into the sand. Now, it turned its lights off, let me tell you, but it was a little grotesque to be watching, apparently, because half the crowd disappeared. And then, it's too big to carry up to the condo, and it's absolutely too big to carry up to the condo because you get all these steps. So I have Cindy go get my other good knife that I prepare fish with. And I just tell everybody, anybody's got a weak stomach, never seen anything worked on before, it's best y'all just go on down the beach. And actually, two or three families sit there and watch me, and they were amazed. They've never seen a fish that big taken apart. And all I basically did was just take the fillets off. You know, nothing special. But when you have a shark that's probably 14 inches wide, 15 inches wide, the fillets come off of that thing like a great big whole ribeye off a cow. And they've never seen anything like that before. You know, and then some of the people were just amazed that I would know how to do that. And I would, you know, catch my own fish and we'd eat it. And that was cool. And it was green and all this type stuff. And it's been a trip. So, you know, that's, my wife could tell I was getting grumpy from all this moving back and forth and trying to move all these 55-gallon drums of bait and stuff like that. So she did me a reprieve, I guess you could say. And I had a good time down in Florida. We had one day of 15 inches of rain, and that was something else. Looked out in the cars, 18 inches in the water. And, went out and did some fishing, ate some good seafood, had a good time, come back. Now I've got... two guys coming in Wednesday that I'm going to try something. Now, this may or may not be for you. This may or may not be successful. I have really no idea, but it's something I've thought of, and I'm going to go ahead and try it. I've got two guys coming in from Illinois. They know the deal. I'm not charging them for the instruction like I normally would, because I know this is going to be very aggravating for them in some aspects. But what I'm going to do, guys, is I'm going to film from start to finish of coyote instruction. And maybe some raccoon and some other stuff, but mostly coyote and bobcat instruction. And I'm talking everything. Their questions when they're doing something, when I'm doing something, when we're talking about locations, when I'm telling war stories, the whole nine yards is what I plan on doing. Now, this thing may be 5 hours of video. It may be 20 hours of video. I have no earthly idea what this is going to curtail. I'm going to have two cameras, and I'm going to have a pocket full of SD chips so I don't lose footage. So if that's something you're interested in, you know, it's not going to be cheap, but it's not going to be anything like pay me for instruction. But you're going to get the full course. Nothing's going to be held back. Nothing's going to be done behind camera. If you buy this course, you're getting exactly what it would be if me and you went out and spent 2 days on the line, coyote and bobcat instruction in Fox. We're going to go over every single thing that I would do on a normal course. Now, I don't know what I'm going to charge for it. I don't know how many hours it's going to be. If it turns out looking like crap, I'll just tell you it looks like crap and that was a waste of 3 days. But hopefully it works out. And the reason I want to do that, there's a lot of guys that want the information. But if you're in Maine and you're going to drive down to Tennessee, you're talking 2 days of driving, 2 or 3 days of instruction, 2 days driving back, all that expense, you know, $500 or $700, $800 for instruction, and then all the expense to get here and back and losing work, it's almost cost prohibitive to a lot of guys. And I know because of, I still get all these requests for instructions, I'm thinking this is a way I can slash the price of what it is. And that way, you'll get everything that I know when it comes to coyotes and bobcats and fox. So we're going to go about it that way. Now, tonight's show is actually Dustin Drews, used to live in Nebraska, did some writing for me on Wolfer Nation. He's now a state trapper in South Dakota. And he texted me and wanted me to do a show on lures and baits. And I thought he was asking me on how I make lures and bait and what ingredients and what the each ingredients does and this, that, and the other. And I'm just here to tell you, from a lure maker's point of view, there's no way. Absolutely no way I would do something like that. And then when I told him that, he's like, no, you misunderstood what I meant. And what he wants is someone to just go over the different baits and lures and how you use them and when you use them and kind of the reactions and stuff you get off of them. So I'm gonna start pretty generic, and then I'm gonna work it down, and I'm gonna have to talk about my lures. And I don't want you to think this is a commercial, because I'm trying my best not to turn it into that, because that's not the point of it. But there are certain lures do certain things, and they do it better at certain times of the year. Now the problem's gonna be, as the trapper, is the lure maker competent when he makes the lure, and is he competent enough to explain to you what it is or how you use this lure when you go out and use it on your own line? That's where the tricky part's going to be, because there's a lot of guys that just make something and put a label on it. Then you got guys that really get into making lure bait. You know, like that is, I'm very obsessive about lure bait. You know, how to hold it at certain time in the field. What's it do in the rain? What's it do when it's dry and hot? What's it do when it's cold? You know, does it make a difference if it's early or late? Different things like that. I'm totally obsessed with that. Unfortunately, there's a lot of guys that just get a formula off the internet, or they just throw some crap together because they're already selling supplies and they've got a lure shop and they have it at conventions, and they really don't know what's going on with them because they really don't test them. And you know, I'm going to be straight up with everybody. When I first started making lures, and the first convention I believe I went to was in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and I'm sitting there with my Art of Professional Beaver Control, at that time VHS, on the table, and like three bottles of lure, and I had, you know, like a dozen with me of each one. And Dave Edwards, which has since passed away, was from Allegheny, New York, and he was sitting next to me. I didn't know Dave from Adam. And I think Matt Jones was given a demo, or somebody, I think it was Matt. Anyway, it cleared the building. I mean, there wasn't nobody in there. So the dealers kind of get up and start roaming around, and Dave comes over and he smells my lure and he cocks his head sideways and grabs another one, does the same thing. And I still don't know who he is. I see he's a lure maker, but that's all I know of him. And he starts asking me questions. And he would pick out an ingredient that was in the lure that you really couldn't smell and go, why did you put that in there? And, you know, and I'm kind of hesitant to say anything because I know who he was. And he could tell that. So he said, well, let me ask you a question. Where did you get these lure formulas from? And that kind of took me back because I didn't buy them. I didn't get them offline. I didn't get them from a rumor mill or whatever. The way that I did lure, and I only had a couple. I think I had Muskie, Enrager, Beaver Buffet, and it may have been Fur Check. It wasn't many. It was just three or four lures. And the only way I knew how to do it from talking with O'Gorman when I was out there, because he ain't going to tell you nothing what was in his lures, is I would do a bunch of reading. I would do a bunch of studying. I would play around. When something smelled like something would work, I would go out and I would run dozens and dozens and dozens of test sets all year round. Even if I was going out of state and doing predator control work, I would go away from where I was trapping, and I would put in a lot of test sets. No traps, no stakes, no whatever. It'd be dirt holes or flat sets in sandy areas or something where I could see kind of what's going on. And I would run dozens and dozens of these sets, and about every 3 or 4 days I'd go back. I'd have my little notebook. I would see how they came in, how close, did they dig, you know, did they look like they rolled? Did, you know, I mean, I was trying to figure out what was going on with these lures, and more importantly, which ones got the most reaction consistently. And I tried dozens and dozens, and those four at the beginning was the only things that I had that were consistent. And when I told him how I was doing it, he was just mystified by that, honestly. And he came around the table and he sat down next to me. And he put his arm around me, I'll never forget it, and he gets real close to me, almost like he's blowing in my ear, and he goes, if you would have added this, it would have done this, because and he started getting into chemistry. And when I was thinking about what he was saying, it didn't make sense to me. And I'm like, well, why that? And he goes, well, this will react this way, and that'll react that way. This will allow that odor to stay there longer when you're out. And I could tell I was talking to somebody that actually knew about lures. Actually knew about lures and not just made some lures. And we became very good friends. And until he passed away, we talked all the time and I'd bounce ideas off of him. But the thing about Dave that really helped me as a lure maker more than anything else, very rarely would he give me an answer. But he would always give me a path. And if I couldn't figure out the path, he would give me another set of clues, and he would make me work out my answer myself. And that, guys, is how you become good at something. Instead of someone just giving you an answer, you've got to find that out for yourself, because there's a lot of variables involved with that. And that is through Dave Edwards, and I've spent some time talking, a lot of time talking with Johnny Thorpe about lures and bases and stuff like that. And I've had the pleasure when I was making Boss Dog, I was using actually alligator oil inside of Boss Dog, which I still do, but it does some weird things with other ingredients. And Dave sent me to Mike Bargiotta, and I got to spend about an hour on the phone with Mike, and I bet I learned 20 years of experience why he worked through the problem, what was going on with that alligator oil. So I've had some very competent people help me out over the years, but very rarely did any of them just give me an answer. You know, I was floored. You know, like some of the things Dave Edwards would do that would just blow me away is I would go, you know, I'm having, you know, I've had real good luck with GH2 and I've been playing around. And just off the top of his head, he could rattle off the formula to GH2 or Carmen's Canine Call and this, that, and the other. And then he would go, but don't copy that. You need to make it better. And let's think about this, because that formula is kind of lacking in this one area because, and what can we do about it? And that's the way that my process has been with lure making. And I think it's allowed me to get out of some of the more basic stuff and really get into, like I said, lure making is just fascinating. I'm not going to keep going on about it, but it's just, it is fascinating when you get into, and you really, really get into it. You know, not just mixing caster and this together, but I'm talking about really getting into a lot of the fixatives and the different bases and the different thickening agents and different things like that, and how do they react. It's just really cool. I mean, if you're thinking you want to get into that, jump in, but I will warn you right off the bat, it is expensive. I probably could have bought a brand new Ford dually diesel truck over the last 15 years of all the stuff that I've had to throw away because it was junk when I went to go use it, or I didn't know how to work with a particular ingredient. And when you buy these ingredients, they're sold by the pound, and some of them are hundreds of dollars. So I mean, you can burn a $1,000 bill trying to figure something out in a heartbeat, it seems like. So, but if you're into lures, you know, jump into it. If you're not into lures and you're kind of just curious about what's going on with them, especially if you're neuter trapping, that's kind of what the basis or the bones of this show is going to be about, of what that is. And I've kind of got some notes to start, because I do think it's, you know, as lure maker, you get kind of squirrely when you start talking about baits and lures, because it is part of your livelihood and you got to be careful. I will say this, starting off, I think lure to a lot of trappers is some of the most overrated products that they buy. And at the same time, to a lot of trappers, it's the most underrated, mistakenly, thing that they buy. And what I mean by that, hype and advertising and cool names and a catch picture or a big snarling nasty coyote or whatever, it really helps sell lure. And if you're new to trapping, it's easy to buy into that wholeheartedly. It's easy to drink the Kool-Aid of the advertising when it comes to lures. And if, especially if you're new and you're in, and it's just a American mentality, you think if you buy this that it's now going to be easy. You know, if you go out chumming in the ocean, you're going to catch everything out there. Well, guys, it don't work that way. And it's the same thing with coyotes or cats or coon. You know, like a lot of coon lures are very underrated by a lot of trappers because they think, I'll just use fish. Well, I'm here to tell you right now, there's a lot of things that'll make fish look silly if you go use them. But it's not as cheap. It's not as convenient, and it's not something you're making for yourself. Same thing with beaver lure. There is some amazing ingredients that really, really do some wild things to beaver if someone takes the time to figure those out. Or you can just grind up some caster and put some glycerin in it. Now, the guy that just grinds up caster, puts glycerin, and thinks that's as good as anything out there, he undervalues what a real good beaver lure can do. But at the same time, if someone sees someone with 300 beaver tacked up and it's nothing but glycerin and caster ground up, and he gets that, he can overvalue that to the point where he thinks that that's just going to be the cure-all. You know, almost like those snake oil salesmen. No matter what you've got, it'll cure it. So if you're beaver trapping, you just put this out and they come from miles around to get it. There ain't a lure out there that does that. So wherever you're at in your trapping, you need to keep a level head when you're looking at lures so you don't overvalue what they can do, because you've got to have the trap in the right place at the right time with the right presentation and have all the animal habits in mind when you make that set that just putting the magical lure in there is not going to get it done. I promise you that. And at the same time, if you only look at lure as it's something that someone makes and puts a high price on, and you can do just as good with fish or deer or liver or something like that, you're very underrating the value of a good lure. Now, the point of all this is, it's up to you to decide what is a good lure or what is just a so-so lure. And the only way that you're going to know that is going to go out and put them to use and really pay attention to what's happening. Because you could go out with the best coyote lure that's ever been made, not that there's such a thing, and you put a set in where the coyotes are not working it the way you think they're working it, you're not going to catch coyotes. But the lure brought in coyote after coyote after coyote. So you've got to be able to, that critical thinking we talked about last time, you've got to have some critical thinking. Is it the lure or is it my set? Is it bringing them in or is it not? That's where trail cams are really, I think, educational. Because you can see really quick if something comes up to your trap set, even if you don't catch it. And then you can start adjusting from that point on. Now, I'm a history buff. I mean, like, one of the books I'm reading right now is 1941. Or 43. I've already read that one. 1943. So I love history. You know, and that's what was America like when the pilgrims came, and why did they come, and what did it do to the land, and how did the Indians react? I love stuff like that. That's the book I'm reading right now for enjoyment. So I'm into history. I do the same thing when it comes to trapping. I've got some really, really old books. I've talked to a lot of old-time trappers that talked about many different people. And I always kind of lead it, well, who made really, really good lure? And one of the interesting things that I found, and I'm gonna use Bud Boda as an example. I've never met Bud Boda. I wouldn't know if he showed up at my house. He had, back in the 80s, a red and a blue, or a green and a blue, or a green and a red coyote lure. One of them was actually made from certain processes of a turtle. And Johnny Thorpe said that was a hell of a coyote lure. Everything else he had, you're doing good to catch possums and house cats. But that one lure was it. So either he got really lucky, or he got that formula from somebody else, or whatever. So just because someone has a lure that really works for you, you're going to have to test out the other ones. And I recommend, on my stuff, test the living snot out of it. I have. Because I'm not going to put it out if it wouldn't pass the test anyway. But this is kind of the history of lure making. You know, when you go back to the mountain men, basically it was beaver caster and a high grain alcohol. And they made this little mixture with it, and that's what they caught beaver with. And it wasn't really until about World War II, about that time, that it seemed like people got out of the idea of beaver caster for beaver, or urine for everything else. And then they started playing around with different fishes and different things like that. And it kind of led us to where we're at now. And the guys that I could tell that really, really were on their game when it come to lure making was Herb Lennon, Mast from out in California. He had some really good coyote lures. But I think the hands down modern lure maker that knew, and probably knew more than anybody of us knows today, is Bill Nelson, hands down. And what Bill Nelson did was take very generic, simple, stinky concoctions of fish and rotted meat and rotted glands and different things like that, and he built a lure to do a very specific thing. Or he built lures, what he called call lures. Don't confuse that with long distance call lures where they're skunky. But call lures, the way Bill Nelson meant them, where they call the animal on very different avenues. That could be curiosity, it could be territorial, it could be hunger, it could be sexual excitement. It could be breeding. It could be territorial. It could be a lot of these different things. And what he did, he was the first one that I could tell really did this and did it well, was combine different things to get different reactions to animals. Now, why is that so important to a trapper? Well, basically, it's important because animals have personalities. They're not robots. They're not mechanical devices that just smell something and do something. And they're just like me and you. Like, I love liver. If I ever want to gross up Albert Simpson when we're down in Texas, let me fry up some liver. He will leave camp. We're both humans. We're both males. We both trap. We're both outdoorsmen. I like fried liver. He's not going to get nowhere around it. He won't eat bobcat. Love bobcat. I don't know if he ate the deer hearts or not. But, I mean, you get the point there. We're from paper, we should like the same things. But we don't. And having lures that call in different aspects can do different things. So you might get an animal over there that's curious by something that's in a lure, and then get him hungry by something's in that lure, or sexually excited with something that's in that lure. Or you may get him over there because he smells food, and then you turn him on because it's a territorial reaction. These are different calls, the way that Bill Nessen was talking about. And it was really astounding what he's done with lures that we have today. Because now we can look at stuff and figure out what these different components are. If we can put them together, will they do what we want them to do as lure makers? So then that's one of the biggest things with a lot of homemade lures and baits that a lot of guys really miss out on a lot of fur. Not that they're lure makers smarter. That's just their wheelhouse. You know, that's what they think about all the time. That's what they tested. That's what they've studied. You know, I'm looking at, I've read all kind of books on perfume making and chemistry because Dave Edwards made me. You know, because that's where the answers were, some of this stuff was at. And a lot of guys that just make up a real simple concoction of fish and peanut butter for raccoons, for example, or, you know, just some ground up fish with some mink musk in it or something like that for coyotes. Will you catch stuff? Absolutely you will. Will you catch as much as you should? Probably not, because they're very limited in their factor. That's nothing against the person that's doing that. I've done that a lot. I've caught stuff that way. I know people that do that. But when you get into actual lures that do things for very specific reasons on different types of animals, it's really cool. Like you can get a female coyote to fight over territory that a male coyote won't even pay attention to that ingredient. And at the same time, there's stuff that you can use for male coyotes that really gets them ramped up as far as being sexually turned on and territorial responses that a female coyote does not care about. So just urine ain't gonna cut it if you're trying to get to that level. So, but Bill Nessen was the guy that did that. He was, and still is, the grandmaster of animal sense as far as I'm concerned. You know, if I could ever get to be one-tenth of what he is, I'd be tickled to death. And I think we as trappers, we owe it to people like that, you know, to give them the respect and the kudos, even though they're not with us anymore, you know, because he was the main guy. So when I talk about lure scent, I'm talking about what we consider a lure today. If you read the old books, they call them scent, unless they were talking about urine. So you got to decipher that out by whatever they're saying. A lure basically is a very concentrated set of smells or odors that get different responses. You know, lure, I'll be honest with you, lure alone gets an animal to a set way better than bait does and way better than visual does. But the thing about, especially when it comes to canines, a lure falls short when the animal is right on top of it and he can get a full smell and get a grasp about what's going on. It smells good. It's like perfume. And it could be for food or whatever. But it smells good. It's right then. It's right there. it really intrigues them and they come over. But there's not a lot of staying power when it comes to strictly with lure or old time scents, you know, like Bill Nelson used to do. They can catch animals. There's no question about that. The marketing behind lures from lure makers, and I'm a lure maker, there's way more profit per ounce because of volume sold per dollar amount in lure. So back in the 80s, when you had no information, basically like we have today, lure makers went out of their way to put down bait because they could sell lure for $2 or $3 an ounce back then. There's 128 ounces in a bottle of a gallon of lure. You do the math. Or you've got bait, which is not as concentrated. It is not as expensive to make. But the profit also is not near as much for the amount of time that goes in it from a lure maker's point of view. So a lot of guys that sold lure really put down bait because they wanted guys to buy the lure because they can make more money, and they weren't really concerned about what the catch was on the other end. And that seems harsh to say, but it's just a fact of life. Just because we're trappers and we all pat each other on the back, when money's involved, people do some very weird things, and that's one of them. So a bait is normally a food ingredient. A lot of commercial baits nowadays, and a couple of mine are the same way, they're more like lures with a very, very heavy dose of food. So they do have some curiosity, and they do have some territorial type, almost like a call lure, but it's really back weighted with weight. So when an animal comes up and he smells a lure, or he smells the bait that's got some of these lure ingredients in there, now he's got something on the table to eat, and he'll spend more time on there. I think a trap, especially a new trapper, is better off using good baits and not lures all the time than he is ever with using lure and not bait. Because a bait is what keeps an animal there. And until you get the experience to know how an animal reacts at a set, you need him there longer to get him to step on the trap. We've talked about it over and over again. Animals are not formulaic in nature. They do not step 9 inches back and 4 inches to the side. You know, that's the way people make sets. That's not how animals work sets. So, especially for a new trapper, he needs to be able to keep that animal there the longest to get the most paw action over a trap to get caught. So, the lures are very concentrated. They get them there. The baits keep them there. Now the other thing that you're gonna hear about is trailing scents. Trailing scents can be either basically a liquefied bait, but there's nothing there really to eat, and it's more of a curiosity factor or a guidance system per se. You know, the simplest way is people use fish oils for raccoons if they're not on location. You know, the biggest thing is you got up and down banks on the side of a creek, so you put a pocket in because you got the upside bank, but the coons aren't down there, they're up on the bank, so you try to pull them off the top of the bank to get them down in your pocket. So you squirt this fish oil up there with hopes that it's intriguing enough for that raccoon to follow that fish oil till he gets to where your bait and lure is inside the pocket and he gets caught. I use a trailing scent for bobcats in cages, and I use it a lot of times. If I'm in certain situations with bobcats, I use it on foothold traps. It's more of a lure than it is a bait. It's an intriguing type thing for bobcats because curiosity killed the cat, that type of thing. Trailing scents have been around for coyotes, for fox, for all different type things. Some people use urine for trailing scents. You know, basically it's just a very liquefied something that you dribble out or squirt out depending on the cost of the product, to get something from point A to point B, so when he's at point B, he's going to come in contact with your set. And that's what that means. Sometimes a really good refresher on a lot of like dirt holes and flat sets are trailing scents. Just a couple of drops of that will sometimes liven them right up. You know, the other thing is urine. You got fresh urine, you got old urine, you got dark urine, you got clear urine, you got all kind of urine. There ain't no question about that. Well, Bill Nelson was really big into using urine. I mean, if you've ever read his books and talked to people that known him, I want you to keep in mind how he used urine. He washed down his trap bag, his trapping tools, his sifter, his traps, his hands, his knees, his boots. Could you imagine going into a quick shop or a McDonald's with him standing next to you? The sight that would be today for someone to be that much reeking of urine. And then he would put an ounce over a trap set. And his concept at that time was a scent remover. You know, there's a lot of scent removers that have been sold all the way back from hall bakers using groundhog urine and stuff like that, and call them scent removers because it's urine. When I first started, because I was an O'Gormanite and he was a Bill Nelsonite, and I started studying Bill Nelson, I was using urine by the 5-gallon buckets, and I caught a bunch of stuff. But you know, the interesting thing, when I didn't use urine, I caught just as much stuff, so it's cheaper for me not to use it now than it was for me to use it, so I don't really use it, except for bobcats. But that's a personal preference you'll have to come up with on your own. But you have urine, and urine can mean a lot of different things to an animal. It can be who's in the neighborhood, it can be a territorial challenge, it can just be curiosity. It could be, if it's different species, it could just be what's going on. Urine does have a place in trapping, I have no doubt about that. But urine will never, and this is one thing that tickles me about all the deer hunting guys that come over to trapping and stuff like that. They think urine is the end all of end all when it comes to animal scents. And that is ludicrous. And I'll give you a real quick rundown why I know that marketing is the reason they believe that. You can put two does in a pen. You will get about a half a gallon of urine out of those two does in one night. So they peed a quart. Now, if you've got a property with 100 deer on there, how many gallons of urine is that that's hitting the ground in a 24-hour period, much less 5 days or a month? And then somehow three drops out of this bottle, which is the same stuff that's soaked up all over the woods, is going to call every freaking deer within a mile around because it's deer urine. Well, obviously the marketing behind that hadn't really thought that out. But people that believe it, by God, they believe it. And when they try to come to trapping, they think that urine is kind of like a very good call lure in the Bill Nelson terms, and it's not. It's absolutely just not. The old wolfers that use urine and nothing but urine, if you look at the time period, there wasn't a whole lot else going on. And those guys ran 500 and 600 and 700 traps over hundreds and hundreds of miles. Their percentage was really low, but their catch was really high just by the simple way that they ran that line. Now, if you were to give them boys good lure like we have today, Lord have mercy what they would have caught. And if they would have known what we know today, that's what they'd have been using. Just like Indians wouldn't be using deadfalls if they had steel snares. Because when they got them, they quit using deadfall, even though that's what they've been using for millennia. Okay. So that's kind of the different things. You got lures, you got baits, you got trailing scents, and you got urine. They all attract and they all do different things. Now, before I just go through a bunch of lures and kind of what they do, because I'm going to use mine kind of as a example list, you've got to understand that there's lures that are for catching animals and there's lures that are for catching trappers. And the biggest examples of lures that catch trappers, a lot of times have skunk in them for no other reason except to catch trappers. Because most guys, me included, when you get started, you go to a convention, you're thinking, I don't know what you're thinking, the coyote's like a catfish. It's got to be stinky and loud, and skunk is stinky and loud, so that's what you buy. And you go out, and you're every time you open that bottle, it's crisp, it's fall time, you're having a good time, you're looking around, you're smelling that skunk, you're putting in these sets, and you finally catch a coyote or a fox or whatever you're after, and your brain automatically remembers that. So it's really hard for that particular trapper not to always think that skunk's the key. because that is what they're picking up on inside of that. Like, if you knew what was in Carmen's canine call, for example, I know what's in there. I've made it. What catches coyotes in Carmen's canine call has nothing to do with the skunk. Nothing to do with the skunk. It may push it out there a little bit. Two of the ingredients in that is so high in amino acids that an animal wants physically to put that in his mouth because his body knows that that's healthy for him. And he smells it and he works the trap set. That's what Carmen's canine call works the way that it works, because of those. The skunk, the odor that me and you smell when we pick that up, because you can't smell the other, is for trappers. That's why there's, especially new lure makers, when you go smell their stuff, 80% of it's going to be loaded with skunk. Trapper's bite. That's all that lure maker's got to know from that point on. Hopefully they use some good bait with it or something like that to catch some stuff. But you got to understand, you got animals that are for catching, you got lures that are catching animals, you got lures that are for catching trappers. And you're going to have to do your due diligence to figure out the difference. And the biggest thing is find out people that's catching stuff and find out what they're using. You know, there's a lot of regional stuff goes on with that, but you've got to know all that. So that's kind of like getting into the baits and lures here. This show may run a little long. Oh, yeah, it's going to run long. Okay. So I'm going to start with predator lures on my website. And I'm just going to run down because these are alphabetical on my thing. You've got a bobcat rub lure. If you hear rub lure, at least what the lure making is attempting to do is to get an animal that's going to physically want to rub on that lure. And 9 times out of 10, it's going to be under its chin or under on the side of its face, underneath its ear and close on its neck. And what an animal wants to do with this is they're trying to wear it like perfume. There's a lot of ingredients on certain animals like bobcats and fox. Some on coyotes, but not as much. And I've talked to a trapper in Montana. He's wearing wolves out with a rub lure for bobcats and walkthrough sets. So apparently wolves like wearing perfume just like bobcats do. But a rub lure is for that. Now, rub lure, the cool thing about a rub lure, it's not season dependent most of the time. Unless someone's trying to make a spike gland lure or something as a rub lure. Because what it is, they're wanting to wear it, they want it on their body, and they'll rub up against it. So you have to make your set. Some people call it a projection set, where the animal and your lure is going to be exposed, and it's going to be, dependent on your animal, anywhere from 12 to 24 inches off the ground probably. And you walk them through a walkthrough to get their feet where you want them, where the trap's sitting there, where they're going to be standing. And it works very well. But that's what a rub lure is. Next thing I've got is a bobcat trailing scent. This is a very potent trailing scent for bobcats. I'm sure there's other people that make stuff like that. It's not urine. It's not fish oil. If you smell it, you'll know very quickly that it's not either one of those. But what it is, at least the way I'm using it, is to get a cat to line up to exactly to where I want him to line up. And sometimes, like on a cage, it helps them go through the front door, smelling the ground, because I'm using dirt to get them in there. So a trailing scent. Trailing scent, a lot of guys sell them for raccoons, which are a lot of times fish oil mixtures or molasses mixtures, different things like that. They do help. Trailing scents do help. And if you're wanting to get into something to make on your own, a lot of times, at least on raccoons and stuff like that, or even red fox, your own trailing scents is a good place to start. Because, you know, if you screw it up, you didn't really hurt anything, and you can rely on something else at your hole. But, you know, just a straight shellfish and menhaden oil for raccoons works really good. You know, you get some good trout oil, and some catfish oil and stuff like that, you'll stop a coyote dead in its tracks most of the time. You might not get him to work your set, but you'll stop him. He's definitely going to know something's going on. And that's a simple thing that guys can do. Now, me talking about, I'm going to say Boss Dog. Boss Dog is a call lure in the Bill Nelson form. That lure will work on coyotes anytime. Just the way that a lot of Bill Nelson stuff does, a lot of O'Gorman stuff does, Bob Jamison stuff does, a lot of different lure makers, they make true call lures. A lure maker can pick up on it pretty quick. And what that means is it's working off the territorial response of a male coyote mostly in there. You've got some hunger factors, you've got some curiosity factors. You've got a lot of different things that's going on inside of that that really make a coyote spend a lot of time at a set or a fox or whatever. But that is a true call lure. Now, I've got Cat Collector, which is a call lure for bobcats, and it's the same thing, but the ingredients are totally different. And it also works very well on coyotes. But that's kind of what that is. And then, you know, there's Cat Fancy. Now, Booty Call shows up down here. Now, Booty Call is a gland lure. Now, gland lures can do a couple of different things for you. Most of the time, a gland lure doesn't really start shining until about December, all the way through about July. Most guys aren't trapping that late, but that's about when they really, really start to shine. A lot of times it's a curiosity type factor. You can put some under some droppings. You can just smear some on a bush. A coyote coming by just wants to know who's around. He gets over there. A gland lure by itself, I tell you one thing, you're not going to get a lot of foot action. You're going to get a come up, smell, and leave reaction almost all the time. They're not going to try to eat it unless the lure maker put something in there to get them to do it. Now, Booty Call has got something in there to make them stay longer, and they also want to wear this very similar to a rub lure. Some gland lures are fresh, some are rotten down. Mine are fresh. There's a lot of good ones that are rotten down. Some people add droppings to them, some people add urine to them, some people add sexual ingredients like lovage and different things like that to them to try to get them to do different things. You're going to have to figure out which it is that you need it to do. Most of the time, though, you're wasting the gland lures until about December. I'm just giving you a heads up about it. You're better off with a good call lure and a bait early season than you are wasting gland lure. Gland lure, or even something like a yoke dope that's a hyper gland lure, which got a lot of different style ingredients, almost like a call lure, but it's so heavy in glands. You're really, for the most part, messing with older coyotes at that time, especially if you're in an area that gets a lot of trapping. A lot of the dumb pups are gone and on stretchers. The older ones are hanging around. You know, they've smelled 6,000 bottles of Hallbaker's, this and that, and, you know, they know exactly what that is. And a very simple set with gland lure, a lot of times when the more generic style lure and bait combinations slow down, a lot of times the only thing that keeps stuff getting caught is gland lure, but it's later in the year. Okay. Now musky, I'm not going to go over all my lures, but musky is one that's heavy in mink. Mink is a good ingredient for about anything. I mean, it really is. There's a lot of different stuff in there besides that, but the there's a lot of guys that put a lot of mink, and I'm telling you that mink is becoming so hard to get from a lure maker's point of perspective. The last mink that I bought cost me about $400 a gallon, and I bought every gallon that the guy had because it's getting so hard to get. So I have a feeling a lot of lures that you're used to getting is not going to have real mink anymore. And they're going to start going synthetic. And I know exactly what's going to happen to a lot of guys. A lure they've trusted all these years is going to fall flat. Because synthetic and real is very different when it comes to mink. Now, Unfair Advantage is a pure sight lure. Now, there's others. I can't think of the name. There's a coon lure out there that's got something that glows in it. Well, Unfair Advantage is a sight lure that's got something to glow in it. Unfair Advantage glows. It doesn't smell. It smells kind of like an old woman to me, so that's not really a attractant type thing. But it's a sight thing. So when an animal looks across a field or down a creek bank or down a high bank or whatever, something catches his attention really, really quick. Now, anytime that you're dealing with something that's visual and you're going to have something that extreme where it glows like that, a coyote is not going to mess with it most of the time. Not unless it sits there for weeks and they get used to it. They're not going to mess with it. Most times, sight lures like this are for bobcats and fox and raccoons and beaver and otter, believe it or not, and different things like that, but not canines, and I seriously doubt wolves. So you got to take that stuff into account. Now, my triple X call. Now, this is what when you read about long-distance call lures. Now, a long-distance call lure can be abused, and it can be a very helpful thing at the same time. Now, unfortunately, there's a lot of call lures on the market that are nothing but a base with skunk in there, or tinctured skunk, or something like that. And that will definitely get an animal's attention. I'm not saying it's not. And when it comes to your Martin and your Fisher, everybody up that deals with that, they know that those two animals come to skunk. Most of the time, guys are just mixing pure Vaseline and skunk together. They're using it up in the season, no problem. A good call lure, a long-distance call lure like Triple X or LDC from O'Gorman, there's a lot of different ones out there. What you're going to smell when you first open the bottle is going to be the skunk. But if you kind of leave that open and you start smelling, you're going to start smelling other things that have tremendous calling ability. There are ingredients that are as potent, maybe not as strong, but actually do a better job of bringing in coyotes than pure skunk ever will. And if you combine some of those with some musk and different things like that, you can have now a long-distance call lure that's got the skunk, they've got these other calling ingredients, and they've got curiosity attached to it. And depending on where you're getting your lure from, you're going to have to find out if it's just skunk or there's other stuff in there. Most lure makers are not just going to say it's just pure skunk. But if you just smell skunk and nothing else, there's a good chance it's just skunk and nothing else. Not saying that that's bad. Now, how to use a long-distance call lure? A lot of times when I use it, personally, it's if I can't find what I consider the perfect place, but I've got the perfect place to catch an animal. So I'm using long-distance call. I'll smear it up in a tree about a head height. I'll have the wind going from the tree over my trap set. So when an animal gets in that wind cone and he starts tracking that, he's going to come in contact with my set before he can come up to the call lure. Some people put them on fence posts. You can put them on twigs. You can put them on feathers for bobcats. You can do all kind of things. Most of the time, though, a true long-distance call is not at the set itself. It is beyond the set with the wind blowing from the call lure over the trap to get a... So when an animal smells it and he goes to circle it, he's going to come in contact with your equipment before he comes in contact with a call lure. Another thing that I will do sometimes, if it gets really cold and it's just kind of a change-up type thing, I will use a very little bit, I'm talking a little bit, of call lure in the hole with bait. The dangerous part about call lure is it gives the trapper way more confidence most of the time than is deserved if he doesn't have a good location. Because without the right location, I don't care how much skunk you put up there, it's not like you're going to draw coyotes in from 300 yards away. But what you can do is if you've got a draw or you're up against someone else's property, it's you don't have permission on, and you see a really good travel lane, you can pull some, let me say that again, some of those animals over to you that you probably wouldn't have had a chance to catch. But don't think just because it melts your nose hair that it's going to draw coyotes in from 1,000 yards away, because it's not. It's just not the way it works. And I will promise you this, from looking at the way a coyote's nose is, a coyote downwind will know that's there from 1,000 yards away, because they can smell deer from hundreds of yards away. Now think about the smell difference between a good LDC and just a deer. So they do know what's there, but don't expect them to come over to it just because they smell it. They're just not absolutely going to do that. So your long distance calls, you can put them in the hole. Sometimes just for change-ups on baits, like gator bait or federales or primal paste bait or something like that, I will mix in a half a tablespoon of a triple X into those baits just to give it a totally different odor, because it's got all those kickers in there that can enhance and be something different besides what that bait is. So if I'm running 40 sets on a particular property, I may have a pint that's mixed up with a long distance call. I've done it with O'Gorman's LDC the same way. I've done that with GH2, and that's not technically a long distance call, but if you ever smelled it, you'll have to question that. You know, that's a very good lure, stands up on his own, and it is skunky. But don't think that a coyote cannot smell a lure, because if it's cold, you got to have skunk or something like that. Guys, that is a myth. A coyote can smell a mouse under 2 foot of snow when it's 40 below zero. Compare a mouse to a standard coyote lure. That's like 1,000 mice. He doesn't have to have that. You're not going to draw him in from the next county over with it anyway. So don't think that you've got to do that. And if everybody around you is loaded up with skunk because it's cold, a smart trapper will go the complete opposite. Because I guarantee you, if everybody's using skunk, that coyote's going to be habituated to the skunk, and he's going to automatically stay away from it if he's been around it too much. And he doesn't, like I said, you do not need a heavy skunk in cold to catch stuff. I've got guys in Canada and Alaska that are using cat collector with no skunk, and they're nailing lynx. No skunk. When I was in Alaska, the average temperature was 20 below. No skunk. They're also catching coyotes and fox in it. No skunk. I'm not saying skunk's a bad ingredient. Boss Dog's got some in it. Triple X got some in it. It's really the only two things I've got it that's got it in it, because other stuff just don't need it. Not for the animal's point of view anyway. So don't get so wrapped up on the skunk. You know, you got different type of gland lures. When I'm going down through the list, I got booty call, bobcat gland. And I see there's a coyote gland, there's a bobcat gland. You can intermix those. It doesn't matter if it's coyote gland at a bobcat set, or bobcat gland at a coyote set, or fox gland at a coyote set, or gray fox at a bobcat. That really doesn't matter. Most of the effects of that gland lure is going to work regardless of the species that it is. Especially fresh glands that are preserved fresh, so they smell like the butthole of something. Because, you know, when a dog goes up, it smells the butt of another animal. That's just what it does. It doesn't go up and smear the ear butts or the foot pads or the liver. It smells the butthole. And that's all I want in mine, is the butthole and a few kickers. That's basically all it is. And the kicker is a very natural product that I use in both of my gland lures that they will want to wear as perfume. And it's very unassuming, especially when you smell it. But, you know, that's kind of the predator lures you're looking at. Now, we're going to go over to the beaver. Now, you got castor, and you got food, and you got curiosity lures when it comes to beaver. Now, I'm going to start off with a food lure. To me, this is one of those things that I'm amazed how few truly good food lures there are out there. because you open up a catalog from Supply Dealer X, and it says this ingredient is a food lure for beaver. So you get that and you mix it with castor and you think you got a food lure. No, you don't. Or you want to mix it with glycerin or something and you think you just mix that in there. Most of the stuff that is sold by trap supply dealers, just because they have a description, does not mean that actually what it does in the real world. You want to know what a good food lure is? My best one is Beaver Buffet, hands down. You want to know why I know that? Because if I miss a beaver, he steals my stick and eats the stick. I've got it on trail camera over and over again. If I miss the beaver, he eats it. That kind of sounds like the Hobbit movie with the little precious dude. He eats it. That's what a food lure is supposed to do. It's not to draw him over. It's not a curiosity. It's for him to physically put in his mouth and swallow. And a good food lure will definitely get them to put it in their mouth and swallow. Most people sell food lures, and they're basically a curiosity lure of some kind. And mixing a heavy dose of castor with a food lure base is not going to have something a beaver's going to eat. I'm sorry, it's not. They're not going to eat castor. Beaver don't eat castor. So that's not going to be it. You have castor lures besides that are territorial. And they can be a very basic, you know, something with just castor and glycerin or castor with alcohol. Montreal Valentine used to take beaver castors down in Louisiana, put them in Powerade bottles, set them out in the sun and water till they fermented. And he caught beaver with them. Is it as good as something like Delta Red? Not close, but he did catch beaver with them, and it's cheap. So a castor lure can be basic or it can be very complex. A complex castor lure really grabs a beaver's attention because it triggers different reactions from that beaver from just straight castor. And you're wanting, as a trapper, maximum interest when you put a lure out. Not minimum interest, maximum interest. And you're going to have to go through whatever beaver lure you want to use to figure out if it's just so-so or not. A really good beaver lure, like Norm, I pick on him all the time. He can buy every lure I make at wholesale except Delta Red. You know why I make him pay? And Delta Red's probably the most expensive 4-ounce bottle of beaver lure in the country. It's $20 for 4 ounces. That's $5 an ounce for beaver lure. You know why it costs that much? Because it's not cheap to make and it flat-ass works. I make Norm pay full retail price for Delta Red. And you know what? He buys it. And it tickles me to death because we're friends and it drives him insane. But he buys it because it's that good. That's one that's very enhanced to do many different things. Same thing with Enrager. Totally different ingredients. Get different reactions, but they're massive. And you can never get that with a generic beaver lure. So whoever brand you decide to buy, make sure it's a good one. And then you've got another thing with beaver, which is curiosity. Beaver are very curious animals. You know, they're big rats. Curiosity is something they really get attracted to. There are some stuff, essential oils and plant extracts that are not common to 99% of the beaver. And they will come up and they will be interested. That's something like damage complaint. They will eat damage complaint. But it's more, even though they eat it, I still consider that more of a curiosity type lure. So when it comes to your beaver, you've got those three different kinds. Now, otter lure is one of those. A good otter lure is good for bobcats and fox and coyotes. It's good for raccoons. It's good for everything. A good otter lure is very hard to come by. Very few of them actually do what they're supposed to do. But the trick to otter lure is you got to put it in a place that an otter's going to stop. It's got to be in the bend of a river or where they're coming out on their toilets or the bottom end of a culvert where they've got fish stacked up and it's pulled up and it's deeper water. It's got to be where they're hunting or fishing or playing or something to get them to stop. I don't care who makes an otter lure, it's not going to stop an otter. It's beelining down a river to get to a beaver swamp. It's just not going to happen. But a good otter lure, especially the ones like mine that's got a high dose of high quality tonquin in it, it's amazing what that does on other type animals because of that and the musts that are in the otter, the lure itself. So not all these, just like, you know, Delta Red's great for bobcats and coyotes and stuff like that. And most beaver lures are pretty good when it comes to being change up for different type animals, because casters are very universal type thing. Now raccoon lures, now this is one that, oh my goodness, you can get crazy with all the different options when it comes to raccoon lures. And the part of the reason is, I think, is you can catch a raccoon on near about anything, but it's not easy to catch a bunch of raccoons on something. So, you know, you go out and you catch raccoons on fish and you think that's all there is, but if there's something better out there, wouldn't you want to know? You know, I mean, wouldn't you want to try it? Or if they're dry land coon is different than a wetland coon. I mean, they're the same animal, but one will react different to the other one. In the mountains around here, you know, the sweet type stuff just doesn't cut it. And a lot of times in Texas, the sweet type stuff don't cut it on those either. It's the same animal, but it doesn't react the same. You know, and when it comes to your raccoon lures, you've got sweet, you got super sweet, and then you've got stuff with back tones to them, which it's kind of like a good Japanese restaurant. Well, they'll have different yin yang things going on where you have sweet, and then on the back side of that, you're going to smell something that's tangy or sour or something like that. Raccoons dig that combination. They really dig it. I don't know which one they smell first, but that combination is right through there of what's better. So to me, if you're playing with pure sweetness, you know, just dealing with straight persimmon or straight, I don't know, something that's just, you know, if you ate it yourself, you'd be a diabetic in 5 minutes. That type stuff will catch raccoons, but you're gonna have a lot of raccoons that'll walk right past it. Now you've got raccoons lures that are liquid, you've got them that are baits, you've got them that look like they're jelly type stuff. You know, all that's pretty irrelevant when it comes to the lures. But you're going to have to go out and you're going to have to test which ones do best. And don't get in the habit, guys, of falling for this is always work. You should really be trying different things, because what you're going to find out, something will work really good for you for 2 or 3 years, and then it goes dead. And there's no reason for it. And then you got to figure out something else or suffer. And then you can come back next year and it's kicking butt just like it did those years before. It's just the way it is. So you got to be observing what's going on in your trap line the whole time. Now, raccoon's one of those things that I do think a lot of guys could make some decent stuff, you know, just because they're gluttons. You know, the more simple, especially the more sweeter type stuff, you need to be on location a whole lot better to get them to play with it a lot of times. So you need to keep that into account. What I found with raccoon, either lure or bait myself, early season seems to do a lot better. Later in the season, going into more predator style baits does better. Like when I first start the season, I'm using monster grizz bait, which is very sweet and it's got a tangy aftertaste, or I'm using blitz coon, which has got a sour aftertaste with sweetness in front of it, and then I'm putting that with coon crack on top of it. Those two combinations do very well early season when a lot of guys are trapping raccoons. But once the weather starts getting cold and starts getting nasty, and the season's been going on for about 3 weeks, if you switch over to something that is more, quote, coyote, like Federales, you will be amazed at what your catch does. You know, then that's not technically a raccoon bait. but it technically catches the snot out of them if you go and use it. So if you start sweet, and as soon as you see that starting to drop off when it shouldn't, switch over to something that's meat-based. You know, and you can, something with beaver or bobcat or deer or mule or horse or whatever it is you're wanting to go with, switch over to something like that, more like a predator style bait, and watch what happens. For one, you'll catch bigger coon, and this even goes in DPs. My favorite thing, once we started getting cold this year, and I used it down in Texas the same, was Federales, which is more of a predator bait than it is anything else, and it's got coon crack, which is sweet tasting, but it's also got the stimulant in it. So that those two combinations, once I could get their little hands in there and they got the stimulant on them and they could smell the meat, my God, they were going to town. It was like Chinese buffet going on. But it's not the super sweet that most people think of. So if you're going to get into making these things super sweet early and then back out of it and start going to more ruder type, coyote type stuff, or even a fresh meat with some type of kicker on the back side of it. You've got dry, you've got wet. You know, there's a lot of people are using fish pellets and stuff like that now, and they're soaking them in different things. No doubt they'll work. No doubt. And it's much better than just straight fish pellets, I'm sure. The, you know, like cracked corn, you can get them to, coons come to a corn pile, but they don't really seem to work DPs that way. And coon, is, believe it or not, and I've talked to Blackie about this before, that a good raccoon lure, a good raccoon bait is one of those undervalued thing in the trapping industry to the 10th degree. Because you can get on YouTube and have every 15-year-old kid out there giving her a formula of their super secret sardines and peanut butter mixture that'll catch every single raccoon that comes down the line. But you know, there's very few actual 1,000 coon guys that do that. If you knew it was in Red O'Hearn's bait, you'd know exactly what I'm telling you is the truth. It's not just fish. It's not just sweet. And there's a lot of ingredients that are unusual that raccoons like, and there's a lot of unusual ingredients that raccoons are very turned off by. So if you're going to get into making it, test. Test, test, test. And I'm not sure what else I can say about raccoons. So... and then the last thing I'm going to talk about is baits. Guys, I am a huge believer in baits. And I wish I wasn't, because as a lure maker, I could make more money if I just sold lures. But I know when I go out trapping, every single coyote set I've got, I almost say every single, 90% of them are going to have bait. I may not use a lure, but by God, I'm going to have a good bait. Same thing with raccoon. Same thing with fox, not so much beaver, muskrat, stuff like that, or otter. But when it comes to the canines and the cats, a lot of times, and different things, bait is king, because it keeps them there. The lure gets them there, and the bait keeps them there. It's kind of a 1-2 punch that you just can't get away from. If you make a bait that's too much like lure, it's this acts like lure. You can add kickers to bait, but you gotta let bait be bait, or it's just a lure that doesn't work very well. And with raccoons, it could be fish. If you're gonna use a raccoon lure, use fish. Better yet, use muskrat, beaver, something like that. A lot of raccoons just are not fish eaters. I'm sorry. I mean, I know that's what everybody thinks. I take that back. Most of your bigger coon are not fish eaters, until they get drove back to the creeks and rivers when everything else is froze up and that's the only food source they have. But you know, you got fresh baits and you got tainted baits. You've got all these different type baits with everything in between and everything added. The best thing you can do is get a couple new ones every year and just try them. And if you go somewhere different in a different state, try them there too. Because what you'll find out, and it doesn't matter who makes them, some baits just work better sometimes in some locations than others do. And there's no rhyme or reason for it. back when I was just using old Gorman's lures before I really got into making stuff, his Plenty Coyotes would not catch me a coyote around here for nothing, and I bought like 2 pints of it. I had a buddy above Knoxville that absolutely slayed coyotes, and he used Plenty Coyotes and Powder River Paste Bait. I gave it to him because it didn't do me any good down here. And we're only 3 hours away, 3.5 hours away. That made that big a difference. So sometimes it's up to you to figure out which one it is you need to do. The fresh bait and the tainted bait, some people think that, you know, use fresh early and stinky later. I don't really think that matters one way or the other. My testing has not showed any difference whatsoever. Like Federales is more a fresh bait, even though it's pretty stinky, but that's because of the kickers. Gator bait is a lot more ranker by the meat, but some of the other stuff kind of sweetens it up. And I think the best type baits are somewhere in that middle ground, not fresh and not just rotten sewage. Somewhere in that middle is that happy ground that most, especially coyotes and fox, seem to really enjoy over the other two. But whoever lure baits you're going to be using, you're going to have some trust when you start them. And then if you see them at a convention or something, you know, if you've got some questions about it, ask them. If a lure maker is too afraid to tell you if there's glands in it or something like that, you need to go somewhere else. If you were to call me up and go, well, is your gator bait, is it rotten meat or is it tainted or whatever? I mean, it's tainted, but it's not rotten. It's not overpowering. And I'm not going to hide that. I'm not going to tell you what's in it exactly, but I'm not worried about, from a lure maker's point of view, you understanding what it is that you're buying. Because sometimes when you read the description, it doesn't really explain exactly what it is or where and how you use it. Now, can you know, does every bait need a lure? No. Does every lure need a bait? Not necessarily, but I'd recommend it. Can you add lures together? Absolutely, you can. An animal can separate those smells. That's very clear from a lot of studies. So if you add boss dog and then you come back and you add a beaver lure on top of, you haven't hurt anything. Don't think that it's so close of a science that if you put one lure with another lure, that's automatically going to mess it up. Because I don't think that's true. The animal may not like some of that's in there, but really wants some of the other part. Now, how often do you bait or lure? I can tell you, when it comes to me, I will re-lure most raccoon stuff about every 5 days. Because it needs to be, they seem to like it when it's at its strongest. Coyotes, on the other hand, unless I get a massive rainstorm and I think that stuff got washed out, I'll not touch a coyote lure or a coyote bait at a set for a minimum of 2 weeks, and I want to get at least 3 weeks out of it before I touch it again. I don't want to mess with the dirt. I don't want to rub the grass. I don't want to get down and smell it. I don't want to do anything. I want to look at it from the truck window. It's either catch or no catch, period. If the set's in good shape, I drive on. I don't get out. I don't mess with it. The worst thing you can do as a new trapper, especially when it comes to coyotes, is every couple of days you put a different lure or more lure on there, and all of a sudden you've got something that is just so strong, and every time that coyote comes by, because he knows that set's there, it's different. You're going to make him not trust it more and more. So you cannot go up there and keep squirting crap on there and flopping stuff in there and think you're doing yourself a favor. You're not. And new trappers, especially younger new trappers, They overvalue the lure to the point that they think that's what it is. That if I just get a little bit more, it's going to draw them in that much better. And that's not necessarily the case. Now, how much lure do you put on a set? Well, Norm's got this thing that I love where he always says he doesn't trap on credit. You know, he puts a glob of lure down in there. A lot of times, if it's if I know it's going to be wetter, then I'm going to go in and I'm going to use more lure. Excuse my dog, it's got bronchitis.
So waiting for the shots and stuff to kick in. Sounded like an overgrown cat with a hairball. But hopefully she comes out okay with it. But how much lure do you use at the set? Well, that's dependent. I will say most guys that talk about the match head, stuff like that, there's more of a cheapness issue going on there than actual animal issue. They're trying to get a season out of 2 ounces of lure. Kind of what I do is I just run a stick down there and get a glob on the end of it and throw it in the hole or smear it or put it in the pipe or whatever I'm going to do, and I go about it. I don't want to use 2 ounces of lure or an ounce of lure at a set because you're wasting it at that point. But, you know, anywhere from a small marble size to half of that is plenty. You don't have to go crazy with it. You don't have to waste it. When it comes to bait, a minimum is a great big heaping tablespoon. Because it's bait. It's cheaper. You want to get more of that in there. And if you're one of the cheaper kinds, and trappers just genetically are that way, you know, if you were to get a good bait, something like Federales, and you're worried about using a great big heaping tablespoon out of it, well, grind you up some beaver or some deer, preserve it fresh, or slightly taint it, or some fish. And you could easily mix in most good commercial baits as a pint. You could easily mix that into a half a gallon of just preserved meat of some kind. And the bait's going to come through enough that if you're worried about the cost, that'll help you get the cost down. And it's not going to hurt your catch any because it's bait. And it's going to do exactly what you want it to do with it. But no matter what's said and done, I don't care how good the bait is, how bad the bait is, how super the bait is, no matter what the advertising says, if it comes with its own little cup of Kool-Aid for you to drink when you go out and use the lure, if your stuff is not on location, exactly where it needs to be, at the right time of the year, with the right presentation, the lure is going to give you the illusion that it's not working because you, as the trapper, have not done your part. And that's hard to take from a trapper's point of view. But it's just a fact you're going to have to come to terms with. And I'm going to finish this, and I'm going to give Hal Sullivan credit because when I read his article years ago, and I think it's Trapper and Predator Caller, I was amazed what he was saying, but he's absolutely true. He would rather a new trapper use somebody else's lure and then try his once they got experience. Now, when you think about that, if you're new to trapping, that means you can use your brain power to think about what he's saying. Until you get the experience to really know how to use the lure and catch the animal, if a new trapper gets his lure and doesn't catch with it, he's probably never going to use it again. It's the same lure if that same trapper comes back a couple of years down the road and has more expense and catches with it, he's always going to use that lure. So the lure is not always the ticket or the trick when it comes to this stuff. It's just a tool. It's something in our tool bag as a trapper that allows us to catch animals. That's all it is. It's not there's no black magic to it. Some of it's better than others, no question, but it's just a tool to help get there. I mean, if you didn't want to use bait or lure, just go out and stake down a deer everywhere you wanted to catch a coyote, and you'll catch coyotes. No bait or lure involved. Just be messy, and it'll be a lot of work, but it'll work. Or a cow, I don't care what it is. But it's a simplified, convenient form for a trapper to go out and catch stuff is all that it is. Just a tool. Well, all right, guys. I hope I didn't confuse anybody, and I hope, excuse me, that I didn't bore anybody. But and I'm not sure if that's exactly what Dustin wanted me to talk about or not. But I gave it a shot anyway. So Dustin, I hope that helps. on whatever you was looking for. One thing before I quit, this thought about. When you're talking about baits don't always have to go in dirt holes. Baits can be smeared on the side of a tree, underneath a rock, in a hollow of a tree or a log. It can be smeared in grass. It can be anything. It's just an attractant, guys. So don't think it's got a baits just for dirt holes. Don't make that mistake. It's, when I went with Matt Jones trapping with him, almost every single set of his had bait, if I remember right, and most of them were not holes. And that's what really got me towards using a lot more baited flat sets, which is basically just smearing it in grass and stuff like that or under logs. So I'm going to finish with that. You can smear bait. You can put it in holes. You can wear it out on your date. You can do whatever you need to do with it. As long as it helps you catch more animals, that's the right bait for you to be using. And I'll talk to y'all next time. Bye.